2-2 pitch. Swing and a long drive. Deep left. Way back. Gone.
Welcome back to another episode of the Baseball America Fantasy Podcast. This is your host, Jeff Ponce. Alongside me, it's my co-host and resident Blue Jays fan, native of Toronto, on a very big day, Dylan White. What's going on, man? Are you excited about the Vladimir Guerrero Jr. $500 million contract? He is a Blue Jay for life now, sir.
I don't even know if it's officially announced yet. I think there's still some things.
No, not yet.
So I'm cautiously optimistic. It's exciting. It was a bit of a letdown at the beginning of the season, like before spring training started, when it seemed like he had said he wasn't going to sign an extension unless it was by a certain date, and Jays didn't hit that date. And then there was the weird different press conferences, and it just seemed kind of, I don't know, just seemed weird. So very, very nice to see that they continued the talks and the negotiations, and they collaborated on a deal together. So a lot of money. He's still young, but you know, it's probably going to be underwater in a few years, but like, you're paying for like the face of the franchise and just the security of that and the intangibles and like the soft skills that come with signing, your cornerstone player for a long time. I'm sure the fan base is going to react quite well to that. So very good. Very good. Very good to lock him down.
Yeah. And I mean, like, is it potentially an overpay? I've said for a long time, and I think we said it when we discussed it this offseason, I just always felt like Vladimir Guerrero Jr. was more valuable to the Blue Jays than it was going to be to any other team. So I think some of that's built into it. You know, he's also technically a native Canadian. He was Montreal, right? So, you know, there's some of that to it, I think, as well. And he's incredibly recognizable. I think that maybe us in our own bubble, because we analyze baseball players, right? We don't think about just how marketable he is, particularly over the last couple of years with, like, you know, cool haircut, and he's like a big teddy bear, and he hits home runs, you know, and the Blue Jays kind of have nice uniforms too. So I think kids like Vlad. Like, I honestly believe this, and I was saying this today, that I think that just from like a recognizable standpoint, they know who he is and they like him. You'd be shocked how many kids like 12 and under like put Vlad Guerrero Jr. on like the same tier as like Soto and a lot of these other guys. You know, I would bet most of them know him better than they know Mike Trout at this point. You know, so I do think that there's some of that. The other thing too is, I'll say this, like, I think that there is a history of, you know, some of these like power hitters with really, really good skills aging well over a long time, deep into their careers, you know. I think, you know, for one, you know, certainly David Ortiz, and Ortiz hit, you know, until he was 38, 39 or whatever. Nelson Cruz, you know, I think Vlad can kind of fit into that mold of like, you know, your first baseman, eventually DH, and, you know, he just gets in the lineup and hits. He's not going to strike out. There's always going to be bat speed there. Even if that atrophies just a little bit, he's still very strong, you know, and makes just really flush contact. So I think that's all part of it. And there's just not a lot of guys, regardless of position, that have, you know, multiple six war or five and a half war seasons, depending upon which war you look at, you know, under the age of 26. There just aren't that many of those guys, and especially guys like that aren't shortstops, that aren't center fielders, that aren't catchers. They're going to get boosted in their war scores a little bit. So I think it just speaks volumes about how valuable he is as a hitter. And I think if he did end up in a more stacked lineup via free agency, wherever that might be, you might see how many runs he could really produce, and you could, you know, you could see some pretty outrageous numbers. Blue Jays aren't scared to spend money, though, so we'll see how they sort of navigate this over the next couple of years, you know, it seems like Bichette is probably likely to hit free agency. We'll see if they deal him at some point or they kind of ride it out, get the comp pick and sort of go that route. I think you can do either or and score pretty big. The Red Sox have certainly shown that with the comp pick they've gotten back with, you know, Christian Campbell for Xander Bogaerts and then Roman Anthony for Eduardo Rodriguez. They have another one for Nick Pavetta this year. So very interesting how it all sort of shakes out.
I mean, there are some whispers today in the Toronto media that the Jays were starting to talk about extending Bichette. So I think like Hazel May on Sportsnet was talking about, like, there was some talk about it. And Bo, of course, is expressing how it's always been his dream to sign an extension with the Jays and coming up with Vlad. It was like the two of them would be together forever type of thing. I mean, who knows if that's just talking the talk to get the moves happening. But I mean, Jays, Toronto fans, Toronto sports fans are very fickle. If the team's doing well, it's the greatest team in the world, and we're the best fans in the world. And when the team doesn't do well, it's like never heard of them. Like when the Raptors won, it was just like the biggest parade ever. And then like a few years later, it's like no one's at Raptor games type of thing. So if Bo, my point is, if Bo is kind of continues his reasonably hot start this season and it looks like he's doing well, like the Jays fans will want to have him sign an extension. They would love that. And if he's not doing well, they would say get rid of him.
If he hits too much though, he may actually go to free agency, because you know,
right.
I think that's one of the reasons he's probably willing to listen at this point, is it hasn't been a great look over the last couple of years. And if he doesn't have a well above average season, he may not be as desirable in the open market when there is a pick attached to him and he's going to want years on the contract. The Jays might be kind of savvy if they think they can get him. You know, I would not be committing the sort of cash that Vladimir Guerrero Jr. saw, not even close to it. I'd probably figure out the number of years I would have to have at $100 million for Vladimir Guerrero. I mean, for Bo Bichette to sign, and it might be like, you know, four, and you might be like, I don't know. You know, is he a top 10 shortstop in the game? Like, I don't think it's even close at this point. You know, it's more like a top 15 shortstop. Yeah. I think he can probably maybe get there if he rebounds, but we got to see the contact hitting and you know, the power and just like enough speed to be dangerous and kind of push for bases and all that sort of stuff that really kind of drove the bottom line with him. And he just hasn't done that over the last couple of years. But we don't want to talk all Blue Jays here. So we're 8 minutes in and we've only talked Blue Jays. So we have a big show. We're going to talk a little bit about an article that Dylan had cooked up, and I had kind of, you know, thrown the idea at him a little bit, and just kind of guidelines to follow in Dynasty Baseball, and just, you know, some ideas to go in your head in terms of, you know, how to approach situations. And especially if you're starting out or getting deeper into it, I think we probably have a lot of listeners that, you know, aren't super experienced dynasty managers and, you know, might be a couple years in or in their first year or so. So I think this will be a helpful show. Let's go through some news though. We obviously had minor league baseball return this week, Dylan. First guy I want to talk about was Chase Burns. Got to watch this start for Dayton. Daytona, low A, high A for the Reds. They confuse you. Daytona. Anyway, he looked great, man. I mean, he sat 98 miles an hour. I think he hit 100. Like, his 95th percentile velocity was like 99.8. 17.9 inches of ride, so like 18 inches of ride. And it was like a point, his HB was like 0.6, not six, not negative six, not positive six, like 0.6. It's a straight ride cut fastball at 98 to 100 miles an hour over multiple innings. The slider, Dylan, and I'll share this data over to you afterward. But the slider, Dylan, 88, 90 miles an hour with 7 inches of horizontal break on average. So there's probably a few that maybe had 10. Curveball, obviously pretty hard, and then a handful of changeups. So, like, he showed the arsenal, and I got to say, like, he's dotting 98, 99, 100 miles an hour with cut and ride, like, all over the zone, too. You know, like, it just comes out of the hand like he's just launching it. It's just like one of those fastballs that is just, as soon as it comes out of the hand, it's like a heat-seeking missile for the catcher's glove. He's somebody that I am, like, super gassed about right now. And I think in shallower leagues, 12-team dynasties where maybe 100 players or less or rostered, prospects or less or rostered, go get them. Go and trade something for them. I have them in a league like that, like my home league. Shallower leagues, go and get them. Deeper leagues, you might be able to, you know, potentially make some trades, but I bet he's going to be pretty hard to pry from the hands of whoever that owner is at this point in time. But shallower leagues, I think this is a guy to go after. I don't think it's stash season yet on Chase Burns. They started him in high A, which is utterly ridiculous. I mean, he just, like, he overwhelmed these high A guys. He should be in triple A. That's what it looked like. He shouldn't. I mean, even double A, I think, would probably be, you know, light work for him. So it's kind of my take on Chase Burns. I don't know if you got to look at the box score or saw some highlights or just some numbers or kind of getting caught up on everything right here in front of our eyes, folks.
I saw the details of the start when it happened and everyone falling over themselves. I like the 71% ground ball rate was good too. Keep the ball in the yard. I was mentioning before, I've started to kind of like do robo scoutish take on college. And when I folded in like the stuff plus and all that, like the difference, the distance between the gap between Chase Burns and Hagen Smith actually was quite big. It was, you know, after the draft, it was like, who do you like, Hagen Smith or Chase Burns? You know, half the crowd was one way, half the other crowd was the other way. I'm kind of like, that's full on Chase Burns, I think. So I have a question to you, put you on the hot seat. If you have Hagen Smith, would you, who would you add, I guess, to Hagen Smith to get Chase Burns? Like, would you add Justin Crawford to get Chase Burns? Would you add Luke Kuechel to get Chase Burns? Like, where
on top of Hagen Smith? Yeah.
On top of Hagen Smith. Yeah.
Yeah.
Where does it get iffy for you? Like, I'm trying to think of a player like Nick Kurtz.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't do that. I don't even think I would trade Kurtz for Burns straight up right now. No, I wouldn't do that. Yeah.
Namala and Hagen Smith for Chase Burns.
Depends on, I think I start thinking about not doing it, but it would depend upon the size of the league. So like a 30-team league, I'm probably less likely to do that and see if I could downshift to a lesser prospect than Namala. I think that in like a 16-team league, probably. Because I feel like I can probably replace Namala or another pitching prospect. And I feel like I'm upgrading, obviously. I think I would probably lean Burns. Yeah.
I like that. I like that.
I think ultimately I would lean Burns and go that direction. That's kind of where I'm at headwise. But like, I think like that's where you start to get into that territory, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not going to do a McGonagall, a Max Clark plus Hagen Smith. That's way too much, you know. Jack Caglianone is way too much, I think, still at this point. Bryce Rainer, you could maybe talk me into that deal.
Oh, wow.
Okay. You know, yeah.
Yeah, it's good. That's helpful.
I think that's but that to me is Namala territory. Like, you know, you could like Rainer more than Namala. you know, fine. They're both kind of in that same tier range where I think that's where it starts to get a little iffy. I wouldn't do Connor Griffin, but that's because I love Connor Griffin and I've shoved him extremely high. So yeah, you know, I don't think that he does not have the immediacy of Cam Smith, obviously, you know, mm-hmm. which is why he jumped to the top of the rankings. You know, I think Travis Pezzana cycle this week, you know, or near cycle was just like a triple short of the cycle, maybe. You know, he's just, you know, a handful is going to be a great player. You got Nick Kurtz that we talked about how good he is. You have Connor Griffin, who struck out a little bit, also hit a ball 111, had a big game in his first or second night. And it was kind of quiet the next two, but immense talent there. You know, I think you start to look at the top of the FYP, that crop of players is pretty strong, you know? So got off topic a little bit, but I think Burns is right within that mix, you know, in terms of like the top guys, like it's kind of Bazana, it's kind of Cam Smith and Kurtz, you know, and those are the guys that you probably have ahead of them. Cause I do think that there is number two starter kind of upside, you know, maybe low end fantasy ace kind of upside. I don't think he's going to be a number one. I don't want to throw that out there. But depending upon the league that you're in or whatever. I was utterly impressed by Burns. And I think, as long as he stays healthy, it's going to be a really exciting one to see and follow.
How do you think, just since we're kind of going off on tangents here, how do you think the fact Hunter Green would be in the same rotation as Chase Burns, and they're kind of similar pitchers in like, you know, high octane gas and big slider, that they're kind of similar, that do you think it would complement each other being in the same rotation, like a team seeing them back to back, for example? Would that be just like overwhelmingly?
Yeah.
Or would it be like you kind of getting used to that kind of arsenal type? What do you think?
Like just in terms of like, I mean, at this point you see so much stuff, mm-hmm. you know, but it's really good stuff. And if it's located well, I think that's a lot to handle. Your hands, right? If you get jammed, like your hands against that kind of stuff feel a little bit differently too, you know? I think if you're like, hey, would you rather face like, you know, Hunter Green, Andrew Abbott, and, you know, Nick Martinez, or would you rather face like Hunter Green in his prime and a Chase Burns that's now proven he can start in the major leagues and has that kind of stuff, I would be shocked that there's many hitters that would be like, you know, I would much rather face those two guys than face Andrew Abbott and Nick Martinez, you know? So like, and I'm just using the Reds other pitchers as an example, but it'd be anybody. I don't know. Like, I think that teams desire to have a couple of arms like this that, you know, have that kind of firepower and quality at the front of their rotation, you know? But yeah, I mean, I don't know. Would they not have them back to back just to keep guys off balance? It's something to think about. I just don't know. Do the numbers bear it out that, like, if you faced two guys that had similar fastball and primary secondary types from the similar slot and, you know, and yep. like similar movement patterns, all that sort of stuff. Like, is that easier than facing, you know, guys that have all different arm slots? But that's like kind of what you have your relievers for, right? Is like screw them all up with like a bunch of different arm slots in between, you know? That's the jelly in the sandwich. The starters are just the bread, you know? They're just the bread.
I remember reading something when the Jays had their back-to-back World Series in the 90s. That Cecil Gaston, the manager, he wanted to start Tom Candiotti at the beginning of a series. Tom Candiotti was a knuckleballer because he believed it would throw off the timing of the hitters. And then when you have like Juan Guzman or some of the fireballers that Jays had, Pat Henkin, it would take them a couple of bats to kind of catch up again because the knuckleball has thrown them off. So I'm just wondering if there's something like that if you have Hunter Green throwing a complete game and then the next day is Chase Burns, is it kind of like a three times through the order penalty where the hitters have kind of seen that type of stuff in a row? So I don't know. Philosophical. Haven't looked at the numbers. Be interesting project.
Yeah, 100%. But you know what? We're at 20 minutes. We're going to take a quick break. We come back. We're going to talk some quick news and notes, and then we'll get into the meat and the potatoes of this whole thing. So we'll be right back. All right, and we are back. Dylan, we're still talking through some news and notes. We're very excited about the first week. We're excited about Chase Burns. We're excited about Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and his contract extension. He's staying in Toronto for a long time, but we're also excited. I'm going to throw a curveball at you about Nick Kurtz. Talk to me a little bit about Nick Kurtz. You had said something prior to that I find very interesting prior to us recording, kind of about your early stages of running the Robo Scout on the AAA boys.
Yeah, I've been starting to populate the spreadsheet, applying the latest park factors, all that stuff. It's still very early. Like, the average number of plate appearances in AAA is something like 27. Very small sample size. But Nick Kurtz is at the top of the table, and it makes sense because he has four home runs, a 241 WRC plus. He's only 22, so all that stuff adds up to, you know, above average WRC plus, even with heavier aggression. He's ahead of Samuel Basayo, another top prospect, Chase Mydroth, who himself has three home runs and is knocking on the door of debuting. But yeah, Nick Kurtz has been as advertised. You were one of the, you know, the highest on Nick Kurtz coming out of the draft. Thought he might even, there was a chance he might break camp, but there's like an 80% chance he was going to be in the majors by the All-Star break, that type of thing. So I was on a James Anderson podcast, and I was saying that Nick Kurtz had his ADP for redraft was might be one of the steals of the draft, because he was going in like the late 30s rounds. And if you can get, you know, an above average bat with, you know, 20 to 25 home runs, basically like, kind of like a Cam Smith, what we were hoping Cam Smith may be, if you can get that late, that would be very good. And especially with the Athletics playing in sort of a wind tunnel park, it could be very good. So yeah, Nick Kurtz, very, very good so far. The question, though, is he blocked currently by the Athletics first baseman, Tyler Soderstrom? What do you think? You think they'll wait for like a slump by Soderstrom, or will Nick Kurtz kind of force his way in and then he'll DH? What do you think would happen if Nick Kurtz continues on the first base?
You stole my thunder, Dylan. I was going to lead into that next.
I love it.
Since you asked, my friend, and you asked very nicely because you're a polite Canadian, and I am a pro-Canada American, so everybody knows. You know, what about this? I'm going to throw a hypothetical back to you. What if Soderstrom, first base, is what he's doing? Maybe they DH Kurtz. Brent Rooker's healthy. He's fully healed. Mm-hmm. Give him some left field time. I even think the radical idea here, radical, because I've seen his athletic testing and it's very good. Nick Kurtz is a good athlete. What if you played Nick Kurtz in left field? Give him some reps in left field. See how he does. He's a great first baseman. He probably is a better defensive first baseman. Or you just move Rooker to left field. You know, Kurtz plays most of the first base because he's a good defender. And Soderstrom always got to do his hit. Maybe he catches, plays a little first base some days. You know, I think there's options here. There's things that you can make happen because you are the Oakland Athletics, excuse me, the Sacramento Athletics, or just the Athletics, as we say on baseballamerica.com, just the Athletics. You don't have that, like, your team's not that good. You're not the Dodgers here. It's not like you're holding down Dalton Rushing because you literally have nowhere to play him. Like, it's not one of those situations. You didn't sign a free agent from Korea who was highly decked, who's now on your AAA team. You're not that guy. You're not that guy, pal. So if I'm the Athletics, personally, I think you could fit all of them in. But what do you say about my hypothetical of, like, that's like your 2-3-4 hitter right there, right? if Soderstrom's mashing, Kurtz gets on base. You got Kurtz at the two spot. You got Soderstrom at three. And then, or, you know, Butler leads off. You got Jacob Wilson. It starts to become a good lineup. You have a chance to be a pretty decent team in a division that's like a little shaky right now. Seattle's not what they were. Houston's not what they were. The Rangers, we have no idea if that team's going to stay healthy or not, right? And if everybody's going to perform and if they can catch lightning in a bottle again like they did 2 years ago. That's a wide open division. You want to move to Vegas. You want to buy hearts and minds. You want to win over the people of Sacramento. That major market of Sacramento, you gotta do it. You know, I'd have them up today. I'd have them up today if I was the GM of the Athletics. I'll put it that way to you, Dylan. Okay, that's how strongly I feel about this. I actually feel that Kurtz should be up before the PPI deadline because he could potentially hit and compete for an award this year or in the future because he's that kind of player and he's gonna help your team. So, like, it's a win-win situation here, you know? And it's a first baseman, right? It's a first baseman who's had some injury issues. Get him up there. Like, what are you trying to save him? Like, his age, you know, 31 season, 32 season? You're probably going to be able to extend him. I mean, like, especially if Vegas works. This could be your star. Get him up now, man. Get him acclimated. By the time you're hitting the bright lights of Vegas, he might be a two-time All-Star. It's going to take him a while to move. They're going to be in Sacramento for a while. But that was my rant. What do you say about this situation? Because I feel like Kurtz is, I think he's pretty much ready. It's a first baseman. Can he hit? He's doing it at the highest level. What else is there, Susan?
he had some of the better debut numbers with the Statcast as well, 109, 90th percentile exit velocity, didn't chase, barreled it up, made good contact. It was, you know, a small sample size, and he's coming out gangbusters already. I think why not bring him up? I think the Athletics have surprised people in the offseason when they signed Luis Severino, they're trading for Jeffrey Springs. It was kind of like antithetical to what the Athletics have been doing. Their development has been pretty good. Lawrence Butler's, you know, burgeoning star. JJ Blade actually had kind of a breakout season. Shea Langeliers is like a 30 home run catcher. Like, there's some excitement there. Colby Thomas, Henry Bolt, all these guys coming up in the behind as well. Get the fan base, the nomadic fan base, sort of West Coast-ish fan base, energized by showing you're willing to bring, you know, your young talent up. I like it. I like Nick Kurtz at first and Soderstrom DHing, assuming Rooker can play left field. He can kind of do a merry-go-round, like you're saying as well. The DHing Nick Kurtz might, you know, kind of protect him, his somewhat fragility over the last few years, just kind of get his legs under him, get the stamina going, play a full season. Get his endurance there, but I like it. I think bring him up, and then the 2-3-4, like you said, Soderstrom, Kurtz, and Rooker would be pretty formidable with Lawrence Butler, Jacob Wilson. I would put at the top too with his on base, and then even Zach Geloff is another guy that young and pretty dynamic when he's on. So I do like the Athletics, and I think they should get Kurtz up in there as soon as possible.
Let's make it happen. All right, couple of quick notes. Did you see Chase Dolander's debut at all, Dylan? Any takeaways, any thoughts on Dolander's debut on Sunday?
I caught a bit of it. I think it's kind of what you expect in a debut. I'm not totally convinced he can defeat Coors. I'm pretty confident he'll do well outside of Coors. He's probably the best Rockies prospect in a long time and probably will have some of the better stats of a Rockies pitcher in a long time. Whether it's this year, 2025, I'm not convinced. I would throw him in home starts if I had him in my on a redraft or on my dynasty team. I would probably keep him benched for the Coors starts at least. But, you know, it was, you know, electrifying fastball, nice curveball, pretty solid. What were your thoughts on the start?
I didn't watch it, actually. That's why I asked you. I was watching minor league baseball, and then I was out at my kids' lacrosse games while that was going on. I've fallen in love with lacrosse. This is a new thing, by the way. I watched college lacrosse games, both men's and women's, like the women's game as well, Dylan. I watched those on Saturday morning, and then after lacrosse practice, and I got my workout in, and simultaneously, actually, dropped them off at lacrosse and got the workout in, got back at the end of lacrosse. Then had a couple of games, and kids are picking it up. They enjoy it. They really like the sport. It's fun. Good times.
You know? Canada's national sport, actually, the official national sport.
Yeah, so I was going to say, you know, I wish I had it around. I wish I could have played when I was a kid. Maybe I'd be at Lacrosse America, you know.
There you go.
I'd be doing the Fantasy Lacrosse podcast, you know. Who knows? But anyway, I wanted to just ask about the Dolander thing a little bit, to see if you had seen him. And what your initial impressions were on Dolander. Because, like, 6 Ks, 1 walk. He did give up 2 home runs. There were 7 hits. Kind of hittable. But, like, that is very Coors for there to be a couple of long balls for a guy that doesn't have a big home run problem. And then, you know, obviously contact was not much of an issue over the last couple of years for Dolander. So,
So his ERA is like 720 and his FIP is 649, but his XFIP is 3.4. His Sierra is 3. If you go strikeout minus walk, that's 23%. So, like, in some ways, he had a very successful outing. And in other ways, if you looked superficially, he did not have a good outing, but he was BABIPed to death. He had a 385 BABIP. Obviously, that's going to come down. The hard hit percentage against him was like 67% or something. Obviously, that's going to regress in a positive way for him. So it was quite a good start for a debut. So I'm not worried. I mean, he's not gonna be a 1.1 WHIP with a 3 ERA guy this year. Especially when you throw in the Coors factor, he'll be like a 1.3 whip, 1.25 to 1.3 whip with like a 4.5 ERA. So if you split that into home and away starts and just do him in the away starts, you know, he could be a 4 ERA guy, which is definitely serviceable, and, you know, he'll get the K.
Yeah. So I think deeper leagues, it's, you know, for sure dynasty. You're hoping they go crazy in like 2 years and just trade him for some reason. You know, or, you know, he has a dominant run like we saw with Ubaldo Jimenez for a year or two, or just it seemed like he was able to kind of crack the code. He's the only guy in the history of the Rockies with a career ERA under 4 as a Rocky. Ubaldo Jimenez, nobody else. So you got to strike him out there if you're going to do it. All right, let's go rapid fire here. Just want to get your quick opinion. George Kirby throws off a mound. He's returning in May, more than likely. That's kind of good news if you're a Kirby owner. This is kind of best case scenario if he's back within the next month or so, right? Next 4 to 5 weeks, 6 weeks. Like, that's kind of an optimistic timeline, because I was a little worried that it could be deeper into the first half and maybe even bleed into the second half. That isn't to say he couldn't re-injure himself, but that was a major hit because you didn't get anything out of him so far. And obviously, if you had earlier drafts, you might have drafted Kirby even in a redraft. So what's your thoughts there? Obviously, it's kind of good news. You're not a doctor. There's not much you can say about it. But
no, I do have a bunch of Kirby, and I have a bunch of Kirby from after the injury.
Yeah.
I think it was like 14th round or something like that.
Yeah, it was going way too late.
So, like, having him is like – him for the last 4 months will be very good. Also have a bunch of Strider who should be back, not next week, but the week after, or not this week, but the week after. I was trying to parse, like, what's Kirby's situation. And it was like, he had said he wanted to pitch through it. And so I felt that was a positive sign. And so I was more comfortable picking him up in the 14th. So yeah, this is good news, kind of validating that the idea that, you know, you can get two-thirds of George Kirby, two-thirds of a season of George Kirby, which is pretty good. It's good for the game. Like I was saying last week, it's good for baseball to have George Kirby on the mound. So.
The good for baseball guy. Thomas Sajacy called up. He actually started on Monday. Are you buying anywhere? Like, how deep of a league would you have to be going after Sajacy in? Not in Dynasty, but more in a redraft setting, because most Dynasty leagues that we play in, he's probably rostered. Like, he's a good enough prospect and has opportunity that he's probably not sitting out there in a waiver wire if there's 150 to 200 prospects rostered.
Yeah, I mean, a 15 team and a 20 team, and he's long gone, yeah. I'm not a big Sajacy guy. I was actually pretty high on Gorman this year, who had a terrible spring training, but he did pretty well so far, I guess, in before getting a hamstring injury. So I'm a bit worried that Sajacy's not going to be in the majors for long. Like, I think Gorman's going to be back after the 10 days. They've got a lot of mouths to feed in St. Louis too. So I think he got squeezed out at the end of spring training. And so I think that's kind of the default setting, is he's the guy on the fringe who gets called up if someone's injured. Nice little player, but, he's not a star or anything that's going to light up your team. So he's kind of a middle infielder guy, maybe utility, and, you know, you're not that comfortable having him there.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to the next rapid fire question here, because I'm not a Sajacy guy either. He's fine. Quinn Priester traded to the Brewers. In return, Yofrey Rodriguez headed to the Red Sox. Kind of an interesting pickup. They get some cash considerations. The biggest piece of this doesn't impact fantasy, but it makes it a really interesting trade from a real life baseball perspective. So I'll just speak on that for a second. And that is, they receive a competitive balance A pick. It's the first pick in the competitive balance round, which is the 33rd pick in the draft. It's essentially a first rounder. Last year, the 33rd pick was worth $2.76 million and some change. It's going to go up this year. Let's just say it's 2.8 or 2.81. Why this is so interesting. The Red Sox went out and they signed multiple free agents. They lost their second rounder because they signed Alex Bregman. They then gained back a competitive balance B pick or comp round B pick, which is between the second and third round. I think it's the 74th or 75th overall selection for Nick Pivetta when he signed the 4-year deal with the Padres. They then go out and they make this trade. And essentially they traded Nick York for Quinn Priester and now are getting back, you know, a late first round pick or an early second rounder, if you want to call it that. It's really considered a first rounder. And all that bonus pool money, which you can now move around in the board, they signed free agents and let a guy walk that I think they probably didn't want to sign to a long-term deal at 32 years old with his history. They now have more bonus pool money than they went in with, and they actually went in and signed free agents. That's how you do it, right? Something departs. And even that to Pivetta pick, you take that out of the equation. They go and they make this trade, and they add this, you lose your second rounder, and then you're able to trade away a player that, you know, was probably your eighth or ninth starter on your depth chart. That's pretty good. Yeah. But initial reactions about Quinn Priester, I think, is probably the most interesting. Yofrey Rodriguez, maybe he gets a boost. He's got great plate skills. He's got some tools. He can play a position. So he's going to stay in the field. He's going to get opportunities. There's no, you know, questions there of him being positionless. The thing with him, though, is he does have some impact. Can the Red Sox coax more impact out of him with, like, their weight training program and strength program and then the bat speed program? I think that's the interesting thing with him. But I want to hear from you, so stuttering over my words. What's your take on Priester going to the Brewers? Because they are short on starting pitching, and they do have a history of getting the best out of a lot of guys that were there. They got good seasons out of, like, Colin Ray in the last couple of years. I mean, like, let's put it into perspective.
Yeah, I think the Brewers, Nestor Cortez just went on the IL. Jose Quintana's on the IL. Aaron Civale's on the IL with a hamstring. They've got Chad Patrick, who was a RoboScout darling last year, so I think top 10, unsung Chad Patrick, who's made a couple good starts. They have him, Tobias Myers, another one who's injured, another RoboScout darling. So I've been watching this closely because I have Cortez in a couple places. I have Savali in a couple places. I was wondering if Logan Henderson would get the call. How about Casey Hunt? I don't know. And so it's kind of the Brewers were kind of forced into looking for starting pitching. When Priester was traded from the Pirates to the Red Sox last year, we were noticing that he'd kind of changed his mix a bit. I think his arm slot came down a bit. The Red Sox kind of go away from the four seam and kind of focus on the secondaries being your primary pitch. Kind of liked what we saw. I was interested in Priester on the Red Sox. I mean, he's not going to forget the things he learned in his brief time in Boston when he goes to Milwaukee. Milwaukee's good with pitching too. So I'm definitely more interested in Quinn Priester than I was last year. He's going to start for the Brewers. They gave up a lot, so they're, you know, they're kind of invested. So just from a behavioral side, it seems like they're kind of invested and they're going to play him. So that's good if you're a Quinn Priester, if you have him rostered on your team. Is he a front of the rotation type of guy? No. Is he an average pitcher? Yeah, I could see like in a 4 ERA, reasonable whip, reasonable number of Ks. He's still pretty young. So, I mean, I think he's a solid starter. Like if, like you said, if you can get stuff out of Eric Lauer or Colin Ray, you know, you're going to get stuff out of Quinn Priester. So I do like it. I'm definitely more interested this week than I was last week because just the playing time, and he is a viable option, I think, even in redraft this year.
All right, next and last rapid fire question. Are you buying the Tyler Soderstrom breakout?
I like it. I like it. So I started downloading this weekend. I started downloading the bat speed. When I make these tools of like my in-season metrics or whatever, a key thing is to make it so I just have to download and then it just like imports it and then like boom, boom, boom. So I set that up and, you know, Tyler Soderstrom, I was surprised to see that although he is, you know, above average on my metric, he's like a 106 for bat speed or a 105 for bat speed. That's I regress it to. I look at bat speed for all you guys that don't bat speed, hard hit percentage, blast per contact, blast per swing. I kind of blend them all. Those are the ones that I found are most predictive of WOBA and ex-WOBA. He's a 105, so he's above average. He's like top 75. But what I noticed was he actually has he's taken a step back from last year. His average bat speed right now is 73.6. Last year was 74.4, so it's actually a bit down. His hard hit percentage this year in 59 swings, 34%. Last year was 45%, so that's gone down 12%. His blast per contact was 20% last year. It's 19%. It was 14% blast per swing last year. It's 14% again, blast per swing. So he's actually taken a step back from last year. So I think what I'm trying to say is there are kind of signs that this breakout was coming. If you look at what he did last year with the bat speed data and like the blast per swing and the blast per contact, since I'm going off on a tangent here, it's kind of like barrels, right? It's like, how often are you kind of actualizing your hardest swings at the right launch angles and stuff. So as we know, barrels are predictive. So instead of just looking at bat speed, which is kind of like looking at exit velocity, you're looking at like barrel rate with the blast per swing. So I think there were signs last year that a breakout might be forthcoming. I didn't have any Soderstrom in redraft. I was scared away by the batting average. I think that will always be a thing. He's going to strike out a lot, but he's only 23. Yes, Nick Kurtz might be knocking on the door and might force the issue if Soderstrom has a slump. You know, his playing time may be precarious, but, you know, there's a lot of runway for a 23-year-old. The question is, do you trade for him now if you don't have him? I think the person who has Soderstrom now is not going to move him just because he started off so strong. He's like a 250 WRC plus right now. You're going to have to wait till he has a little bit of a slump, but keep an eye on the bat speed metrics, keep an eye on the barrel rates and all that, because maybe it's just a slump and the underlying will still be strong. And then maybe you can take advantage of some of those. Soderstrom and is worried that he's coming back to earth tentatively by.
Yeah. I mean, I tend to agree with you. It's kind of interesting how those underlying numbers are coming up, but he's producing and he's got opportunity right now and he's hot. So I can see riding it out, but yeah, I think there's some healthy skepticism there too, as well. But hey, we had teased kind of this article that's coming out. You broke down some, I would say, kind of guidelines or rules to follow as a dynasty manager, probably especially useful for newer managers, but I think just also good for a refresh. So we won't sit here and talk about through all of them. You can go and read the site, the articles up at baseballamerica.com, and I think it's worth your time. I'll put it to you like this, Dylan. Give me your most important rule. Let's talk about that.
Wow. So a couple things I tease in it is this is sort of like what to do at the beginning of the season, because, you know, it's short samples. Can you really do anything with your dynasty team? So I talk about like kind of knowing what your opponents, like you can already get some information if you didn't know, like, are they following certain sites? Are they, I mentioned like James Anderson's list or like Mike Halpern or like Chris Clegg. If those guys on social media are touting some prospects, then you see in the fab period that those guys are being bid, you kind of know who they're following. So when they update their lists, you can maybe use that to your advantage in trades. But I think the biggest one for me, especially if you're competing in a dynasty league, is take a look at the replacement level of each position. Look on the waiver wire. Just say you need a catcher. Your catcher goes down, you need a catcher. Who's available? How deep is it? How terrible is it? How much of a wasteland is it? Do that for every position. If your outfielder went down, are there outfield options? That will help like give you an idea of the landscape. It may give you an idea of like what positions you're vulnerable at, what you may want to protect. If it seems like there's no first baseman available, maybe when you get someone to throw in someone in a trade, it's a first baseman, even if it's a bench guy like Pavin Smith or something like that. That might be more valuable than what's left on the wire. So I think for me, it's take a look at the sort of the landscape of the waiver wire, especially if you're competing, so you can just get an idea of like where people are vulnerable and what's available to you.
Yeah, and I thought kind of on the opposite side for, you know, those managers that are rebuilding, just kind of your thought of not checking out and, you know, don't disengage is what you actually said. Because there's always players, even beyond trades, there's always players kind of out there in the waiver wire and potentially available that are worth a flyer. You know, you almost got to be like those Orioles teams when they were on their come up in the last couple of years, where they were just using like those last couple spots in their 40-man roster just to try to find something, right? Catch some lightning in a bottle. Kind of got to do the same thing, don't you?
100%. You can't, like, I just see so many teams, at least in my leagues, that, you know, they're not going to win this year. And they just give up. Like, they don't make any moves. They don't pick up anybody. They're not churning their roster. And so at the end of the year, like when the FYPD is coming up, it's like their minor league prospect roster is just terrible. It's all these guys that were good at the beginning of the season, like who were maybe talked about at the beginning of the season, but they've been surpassed by breakouts or they've been injured and are just like not in the discussion of like top 400 anymore. So you got to stay on top of it. You got to keep trying to build value. Kind of need to build future value of your team, whether it's your major league roster, whether it's depth. Try to get assets, to use that lingo, try to get assets that are desirable for your league mates, even if you're not competing. Like, that's, you know, people are always hunting for ways to make their team better, and so you got to be part of that. You have to be one of the options that teams come to. So don't check out and then like tune in September like, oh yeah, my team's terrible. Like, you got to stay on top of it, picking up players and churning.
There's a lot of people that do that too. And, you know, I think like it was funny. I was talking with a friend of mine who's a recently addition to a bigger league that a deeper dynasty league that I'm in. And we were kind of talking about like what the trade, you know, market is like, and, you know, how he felt like it was a little tougher than other spots. And I was like, oh, you got to pick, you know, you got to know the managers that, you know, are going to make deals. And I kind of walked through like, you know, all, you know, numerous managers in the league. These guys will make deals. These are the ones to stay away from. These ones are kind of snakes, but you can maybe make a deal every so often. These guys will just never return your DM. These guys are always going to ask, overvalue their players and, or not be willing to kind of take a chance, right? Which I think is a big part of trading in dynasty too, is like, you know, being willing to be wrong. Like you do have to, you know, gamble from time to time. You don't want to overpay for someone or, you know, get a bad return, of course, but I think you also do need to take some chances. You do have to take some risk. I mean, you want to be risk adverse in certain situations. You want to go crazy with what I'm saying here, but I do think that there's a certain point where there's very clearly good deals that are available that people back out from or don't make because they get cold feet. They're nervous to move so-and-so, you know? So, yeah, I don't know. Go read the article on the site. There's plenty of stuff up there. We've already gone 50 minutes. I don't want to go too much longer for these people out there, but I do appreciate the listenership. Of course, it's been the Baseball America Fantasy Podcast. I'm Jeff. He's Dylan, and we're out.
Cheers.